This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He has done fieldwork in Africa and has written about early man, forensic archaeology, and many other topics. His books on the interaction of climate and human society, including The Long Summer and The Little Ice Age, have established him as a leading authority on the subject. Brian Fagan is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury Press. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What led you to write The Great Warming?
Well, about, and this goes back some time, 10 years ago, I was sitting in a coffee shop with a group of writer friends in the middle of a major El Nino storm. We get rain here when there were El Ninos. And somebody casually suggested, we were talking about El Ninos, that I should write a history of them. And I went home, looked at the literature and said, my goodness me, here's a wonderful book. Got a proposal written and a publisher picked it up. And the rest, as they say, is history. Since then, I've written 3 other climate books, of which this is the latest, dealing with various aspects of, particularly in the last few years, medieval and later climate change. And these books have sort of taken on an intellectual momentum of their own. So I'm really excited and enjoying it. And this one is the last one of this series.
Why did you choose to examine the period of the Great Warming specifically? What did you expect?
Well, about 5 to 7 years ago, I wrote a book on the Little Ice Age, which is a period of very unsettled weather between about AD 1300 and 1860. And at that time, I did note that there was a period of warmer, slightly warmer, more stable climate between about AD 800 and 1250. And after finishing another project, it suddenly occurred to me that I should take a look at this medieval warm period, which was first identified by a meteorological historian in Britain back in the 1960s. And I started because there was conventional wisdom that this period was a period of great prosperity in Europe. And I started off looking at Europe. And when I did, I realized that while Europe had a good time then, the rest of the world didn't, and the book just sort of gained a momentum of its own after that, because I got excited by the global prospects of this.
How warm was the Earth during this time compared to today?
Well, this is one of the big debates, and one of the things I'm very, very tired of are these earnest people who email you and say, do you believe in anthropogenic global warming? Which was the effect of what side are you on? And this is absurd, because the real issue is not whether it was warmer 1,000 years ago or not. We don't really know, and it doesn't really matter, because today we are in a period of prolonged warming. But the actual warmth 1,000 years ago wasn't really a sustained period of warming. It was a period when, in Europe, for example, summer temperatures may have been about 1.5 degrees centigrade warmer than today, and a period when maybe it was a little drier in the summers, and temperatures generally were a little better, to the point where growing seasons were longer. I would say the temperatures probably were much the same as today, maybe a little warmer.
What evidence is used to determine climate in the distant past, and specifically during the medieval warming period described in your book?
About 15 or 20 years ago, a superb revolution in climatology took hold. And this revolution involved new techniques for looking at ancient climate change, both on longer and shorter term time frames. On the longer term time frame, deep sea cores bored into the depths of the Pacific and the Atlantic began to give information on the climatic changes which took place during the Ice Age. For instance, there have been at least 9 major cold periods in the Ice Age since 750,000 years ago. Then people began to bore into ice caps in Greenland, Antarctica, and in the Andes. And in Antarctica, they've got now one ice core that goes back at least 400,000 years. So there was the long, long scheme. And that showed that since the Ice Age, some 15,000 years ago, there has been a prolonged period of warm, relatively stable climate, one of the longest and most stable in the past 750,000 years. Then they also developed or refined the technique of tree ring dating, which was used to date the growth rings of trees. It started in the southwest and has now been extended all over the world. And in Germany, they would oak trees. They now go back 8,000 years or more. And this has produced astonishingly precise measures of temperature and of rainfall in Europe and elsewhere. Now, all of these are what they call proxies. They're indirect evidences of climate change, but they're becoming increasingly accurate. And for the first time, certainly for the last 2,000 years, we can begin to look at climate change on a very small compass, a matter of a few years. And this means that we're beginning to see things like major El Nino incidents and so on, and really begin to measure the impact of climate change on ancient societies.
In your view, what most stands out from your study of the medieval warming period?
The thing that really stands out is that you can't look at something like the medieval warm period or the Little Ice Age purely on a local canvas. The thing that really struck me when I got into the medieval warm period was if you look at it globally, the biggest impression you get is that in many parts of the world, there were prolonged droughts 1,000 years ago. For example, there's one drought recorded in lake beds in the Sierra Nevada, which lasted 140 years, around 1200 AD. Now that, by today's standards, is a truly epochal drought. And when I started looking at this on a more global level, I discovered that there were serious droughts which affected the Maya civilization of Mexico and Guatemala, droughts that affected the people of coastal Peru, as well as a broad swath of Western North America, and also in China. And it turned out, and this is fairly new research, that there was a period during the medieval warm period when much of the Pacific wasn't warm, it was cool and dry. The classic La Nina condition, which is the opposite of the seesaw that is El Nino and La Nina. And this seesaw brought drought to an enormous area of the world. And this inevitably had effects on human societies, negative effects. And this was something that really struck me very early on in the research.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How important a role did the warming that occurred during this period play in how societies developed?
It played an extremely important role, if an inconspicuous one, nearly everywhere. For example, in Europe, as I said, the growing season for cereal crops became slightly longer, a matter of weeks longer, which is enormously important because, for example, you get cereal crops being grown in Norway and even in Iceland. And they were growing vines in central England. They were producing so much good quality wine in England that they were in fact exporting it to France, and the French were complaining. And then in the other parts of the world, particularly in semi-arid lands, the impact was quite different. In the case of the Maya, who lived in an area where water was a precious commodity and where they had sophisticated water collection methods, a drought of more than 2 or 3 years really caused problems because you got fields which were only watered irregularly by natural rainfall could no longer be watered by irrigation. And this undermined a society which was living in a situation at the edge of its carrying capacity of its land. It was stressing the environment. The nobles who ran a society, it was like a pyramid, were placing increasing demands on the farmers, and eventually climate change and a series of intense multi-year droughts were one of the factors that caused part of Maya civilization to implode. So the impact of that would be to make sure that the cities, or cause the cities, their big ceremonial centers, to collapse and the people to disperse into small villages. And we can be sure that many people died. The casualties during the medieval warm period were probably quite high in many parts of the world because of drought.
Could you give some additional examples of societies that had problems with drought during this time?
The classic example from North America is the ancestral Pueblo peoples of Chaco Canyon in New Mexico. This remote canyon is a remarkable place, and it supported a series of what the archaeologists call great houses, large multi-room pueblos, of which the most famous is a semicircular one called Pueblo Bonito. And these, which were built in the 10th and 11th centuries, were remarkable places in an area where rainfall, to put it mildly, is erratic, and where the canyon could really only support about 2,500 people. And these places prospered. They were major religious centers, and they were places that people congregated at certain times of the year for major ceremonies. And then suddenly, in the 12th century, there was a massive 50-year drought, which we can spot from tree rings. And very rapidly, the great houses were abandoned, and Chaco was literally depopulated. And for years, people have puzzled over why this happened and what the effect of this drought was. There are all sorts of arguments, but one of the most fascinating things that in the oral traditions of the ancestral Pueblo, there are strong traditions of movement, that when there's a drought, you move away in the face of aridity and you settle elsewhere. And one of these things these people did was to maintain kin relationships with communities at a distance. And it seems that when this drought hit Chaco, that the people gradually just simply moved away and lived and settled with kin elsewhere who were in more better watered areas, one of which was, for example, northern New Mexico. So there are very complex things that go on, and many societies in those days coped with their vulnerability to drought by moving.
Could you discuss some of the other coping strategies used by societies that were adversely affected by climate in this era?
The most effective one of all, and a remarkable one, is down on the coast of Peru, which, as you know, is one of the driest deserts in the world. And this area, which was watered by rivers which carried mountain runoff from the Andes down to the Pacific, supported a series of states which based their economies on irrigating the flood channels with very fertile soils and brilliant water management. And in the first millennium AD, before the medieval warm period, a society called the Moche used these valleys to create a very powerful, rich society with lavish gold, and we know from chieftains' burials, wealth almost beyond imagination in the hands of a few people. And this society relied on agriculture, which was purely local. But then, by about 1200, there had arisen in the place of this one a society called Chimor, which was a large and elaborate society. And the remarkable thing about it was the almost fanatical care which the rulers of this society put into organizing irrigation. Unlike many societies, they didn't live on the notion that drought was something that happened occasionally. They assumed there was going to be drought. They built large canal systems. There were signs that they organized agriculture very meticulously and controlled it from the middle, with the result that they appear to have weathered the very serious droughts that affected the Maya and others. So there's a success story, one of not too many. We still, unfortunately, don't know a great deal about many parts of the world, like, for example, China, where in northern China, the Huang He, or the Yellow River, is today an environmental basket case, and in history was an area where drought was a pervasive problem. And in the 19th century, there was a drought that killed well over 1 million people, for example. And it's likely that that area also suffered severely from drought in medieval times.
What characteristics of societies allowed people to survive?
There are, I think, a number of characteristics which actually, interestingly enough, also spill over into natural disasters. The first of these, and these are not necessarily in order of importance, but the first one, and this really is terribly important, is maintaining relationships with fellow kin and other communities nearby. Many subsistence agricultural societies, and I'm sure that medieval Europe was one, maintained close ties with fellow kin in villages at a distance and close by, the strategy the people of Chaco Canyon followed. Why? Because in the event of crop failure, they could rely on relatives to help them. So the ties of family, as people have found out with, say, Hurricane Katrina, were of enormous importance. A second thing that's terribly important, particularly at the local level, is decisive leadership, where people take decisive actions to control food supplies, ration food, conserve water. That is terribly important, and that was what the Chimo did, the Chimo people. Then the simpler societies, small-scale societies, like the hunter-gatherers who lived in Utah, Nevada, and California, their strategy was easy. They just moved. They moved to areas where water supplies were reliable, fell back on other foods, and so on. So you've got all these strategies. The people who are most vulnerable, of course, are industrial societies like ours, where logistically, as we learned with Katrina and Rita, you cannot move millions of people.
You're just starting to allude to this, but what can climate change that took place in the past tell us about coping with climate change today? What are the lessons of the medieval warming period for those of us in the 21st century?
The lessons are actually severalfold. The first one, and this really doesn't quite answer your question, but it fits in here, is that projections of a warming world and sophisticated computer models of the future effects of warming in terms of drought are truly frightening. The Hadley Meteorological Institute in England, which is one of the world's leading climate change centers, has produced a series of computer models, which are very sophisticated, of the effects of drought by the year 2100. And they are showing that the proportion of the land's earth's surface which will be exposed to extreme drought, not just severe drought, will rise from 3% to 18%. That there will be a corresponding rise in the amount of earth that is confronted with major drought, and then something like 40% of the earth is going to be affected regularly by drought. This is a quantum jump from, say, the 1990s, when anthropogenic global warming first really came home to roost. And these projections make one realize that the lessons of the past, in a way, do tell us what is coming. So in a way, the medieval warm period is sort of an early warning of what may lie ahead. It also is a chronicle of all sorts of different strategies people use to survive, because we're facing something that they faced, people of 1,000 years ago, on a much larger scale, and were for the first time facing political, economic, and other issues, which are issues that we've got to work on for our great-grandchildren, not for ourselves. And we've got to work on them globally, and this is a very, very different world from the one of 1,000 years ago. Does the history tell us what to do in the future? No. But it offers us encouragement, It offers us suggestions, and it is a perspective. And if you look at climate change without looking at history, you're making a mistake.
How do you see drought stacking up with the other challenges of climate change, such as rising sea levels?
It's fascinating. One of the most striking things when I really got into this was that there's a lot of talk about rising temperatures, rising sea levels, this, that, and the other. But the one thing people really didn't talk about a great deal is drought. And in my book, I talk about a silent elephant in the room. It's a silent elephant in the climatic room, drought. Because for some reason, we seem to deny drought. And one of the reasons we do is that with the exception of the Western United States, and even here, the conversation about drought is rather muted. We are living in a world where much of the drought crisis is going to affect lands that are far away, like Australia, lands that are remote in our consciousness, like northern China, or sub-Saharan Africa, and you've only got to look at Darfur to see some of the consequences that can come, Ethiopia, and parts of tropical Africa. That isn't us, it's them. And I think one of the reasons we have this silent climatic elephant in the room is because an awful lot of this does not affect us directly. But make no mistake, in the American West, it's going to affect us very, very seriously indeed.
Looking at what you found in your book, obviously there were many cultures that were adversely affected by the climate in the warming period and others that benefited. Roughly, what fraction of the total benefited versus had problems?
Very difficult to estimate that, because one of the most striking things about all of this is that we really know remarkably little about climatic change in the medieval warm period outside familiar areas, Europe or the Western United States. But I would say, I'm just guessing here, that probably at least half to maybe as much as 60 or 70% of humanity suffered adversely through the medieval warm period in one way or another. But this is a pure guess. The people who really benefited were relatively small.
And you had mentioned Europe benefiting, but there were a couple of other examples as well. Could you just briefly mention other societies that did benefit?
The most well-known of them are, of course, the Norse, because the Norse were consummate sailors. We all have this image of Kirk Douglas and the warriors and longships and all that. But in fact, they were also consummate sailors and traders. And during the medieval warm period, ice conditions in the north were far more favorable, and this allowed them to, or helped them, to voyage westward to the Faroe Islands, to Iceland, to Ireland, to Greenland, and then eventually to North America. And this sporadic traffic between Europe and Greenland and North America kept up right up until about 1200, when temperatures in the north began to cool. Another group of people who benefited were the Mongols of Eurasia, because this vast semi-arid steppe breathes like deserts do. When the rainfall rises slightly, they suck in animals and people. And the Mongols depended on cattle, who have to be watered every 24 hours, and on horses. And really, and we don't really know much about this yet, during the medieval warm period, much of the steppe probably had long periods of drought and poor grazing. What strategy would the Mongols follow? They would move onto the settled lands at the margins. And it so happened that Genghis Khan, who called himself the Flail of God, who put terror into people, who was a brilliant organizer and governor, quite apart from being a very charismatic man, unified the Mongols, which is very difficult to do, organized them, and it seems that many of the great conquests of the Mongols, in fact, are fairly closely connected to the realities of living on the steppe, which means that when it gets dry, you move to the margins. And had not more rainfall come, it's entirely possible that much of Europe might today be an Islamic continent.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I've written now 4 climate books. And when I wrote the first of them, I wrote to a friend of mine who's a well-known historian and said, could you give me some leads on people who are looking at climate? And he wrote back to me and said, you're looking at climate? Goodness, nobody's looked at that since the 1970s, which struck me as strange. In fact, he was wrong. There were people looking at it. So one of the objectives of all of these books has been to say, hey, look, this is what I found out about how short and long-term climate change affected ancient societies. Isn't it something we should look at, given the revolution in paleoclimatology? And the response to these books has really been extraordinary, and now there is a momentum of research into the history of climate, which I'm very thrilled about. I hope my books, I delude myself, have helped. But the medieval book, I started off to be much the same exercise, but once I really got into it, I realized this was the real incident in history that did have lessons for us today. And I must say the response to the book has been such that a lot of people have picked up on this, and I'm very excited, particularly on the message of drought.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message is, I think, very simple. I think we can argue about global warming and what we're going to do about it, carbon emissions and all the rest, as much as we like, an extremely difficult, very urgent, and very complex political and economic problem. But there's a second reality which very often, again, is ignored and I think is terribly important, and that is the fact that whether we like it or not, we have got to live with warming, and we've got to develop strategies for living with it, not just solving the problem. And these solutions are not just technological. They involve massive changes in our behavior, particularly in the context of rising sea levels, extreme climatic events, and above all, drought. Drought is a universal problem, and I think it's going to break down the barriers between the third developing world and our own. I see this as really the thing I've learned more than anything else from writing this book.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
We have just been speaking with Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations, published in 2008 by Bloomsbury Press. For more information, check on the web at www.brianfagan.com. Again, that's brianfagan.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.